Hello and welcome back to Soil Matters Soil Series, where we use this radio time to investigate our privilege as humans in relation to the soil and the environment. I say we, but today it's just me, Tanya, in the studio, and I'm sitting down drinking a beer. It's a damn hot day in Amsterdam, so I'm planning on going for a swim after this. And yeah, I've been away for a couple of weeks. I was off hiking in Germany, like near the Bodensee in the south of Germany, just near the border of Switzerland, and I had a really, really good time, and it was just like really nice to sleep in a tent every day and to be outside almost 24/7, or you could just round it up to 24/7, and I don't think anyone would complain. And yeah, so that was me, and now I'm back in Amsterdam, and I'm rushing to finish my which will be my first author article, which will be submitted on the 31st of August. That's my deadline. And it's looking at the peat deposits that are submerged beneath the North Sea that formed when the planet came out of its last glacial period about 10,000 years ago. And it marks the transition between the Pleistocene and the Holocene periods. And so today I'm going to read you an article also about peat, but about bog, which is another word for peat, or you could even say a specific type of peat. And a bog usually, it refers to the ground is really, really wet because of the water that seeps up beneath the ground from below. So from having a really high water table, the ground is just super wet. And then this is basically in contrast to the fen, which is like really, really wet because it rains so much in that area, and the area pools, and the ground is never able to dry. And they're the main two types of peatlands, basically, or they get divided into either a bog or a fen pretty often. But before that, I just want to acknowledge all of the Indigenous peoples from across the planet, past, present and future. And I acknowledge that there are many lands that have not been ceded. So this article in Harper's was published pretty recently, just this year, in the July issue. And it's called Bogland. It's a letter from Ireland written by William Atkins. And the subtitle is Climate Change and the Peat Industry's Dying Days. Well, let's hope so. And there's even a map that's included of the bog fields in Ireland. And like, there's some really nice drawing of one of the sphagnum species. There's over 50 species of sphagnum, so I'm not across them all, but this one is very pretty. It's got some pink features to it. So here we go. The sky above Lodge Bog was a tarnished silver, and four crows tumbled across it like blown cinders. It was a scoured, shelterless place, a realm of few verticals and uncertain horizons. The kind of environment humankind has tended to avoid. And yet the bog was flourishing, abounding with life. To stand there felt like standing on the back of some vast recumbent mammal. Lodge Bog is part of the Bog of Allen, a 960 square kilometre swath of ancient peatland in the Irish Midlands. A thousand years ago, Lodgebog was a lake. Over the centuries, that lake became shallower as it accumulated silt from incoming watercourses. Vegetation encroached from its banks, replacing open water with reeds and lilies. As these plants died and sank, the water grew shallower still, swampier, until a person could, with care, wade across it. A few hundred years more, and the swamp had transformed into a fen, soldier underfoot, dominated by rushes, grasses, and mosses. Year by year, these plants also died, forming peat, a wet, fibrous, brown-black mass, until the surface of the fen rose in a dome above the level of the surrounding land. A raised bog had formed. Today, there might be 10 meters of peat. Between a raised bog's living surface and the clay gravel of limestone underneath, the oldest, blackest, bottommost peat might have been laid down 8 millennia before the birth of Christ. I was joined at Lodge Bog by Tristram White, a freshwater ecologist with an outdoorsman's complexion and the cautious manner of someone accustomed to stalking flighty animals. White works for the Irish Peatland Conservation Council, with the acronym IPCC, not to be confused with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. A four-person organisation established in 1982 is the Irish Peatland Conservation Council. Wow, I wonder if it's been the same four people all along. To protect a representative sample of the country's peatlands. Its offices are located in converted stables on nearby Lullamore Island, a rare zone of solid, fertile mineral land amid the surrounding bogs. For centuries, the island was a place of refuge, connected to the outside world by a handful of hidden causeways. Its earliest settlement was a monastery founded in the 5th century and purportedly visited by St. Patrick, whose footprint, a heel-shaped dent, is still visible on a limestone boulder. It was early autumn, and the bog, like the trees we could see on Lullamore, was relinquishing its green. Its colours were now khaki, beige, gold, crimson, ginger, and where peat was exposed or water had pooled, molasses brown or oily black. Small hummocks supported species that favour drier ground, russet-stemmed bog cotton, whose fluffy white boles would constellate the landscape in spring, grey-green heather or ling, which in August would crown the knolls, with blooms of royal purple, devil's matchstick, with its livid pustules of scarlet fruit and tiny tentacled carnivorous sundew, its glue trap leaves primed to enfold insects. The wetter areas were dense with sphagnum moss, the bog's dominant and formative vegetation, its stems tangling deep into the water. So absorbent is sphagnum that during the First World War it was harvested by the ton for use as surgical dressing. I followed White across a duckboard pathway the IPCC had installed towards the centre of the 35-hectare bog. He crouched to examine the plant life. You've got your ling here, you've got sphagnum, this is Magellanicum, and you see how it's got a very stellate capitulum. He pointed to the star-shaped head of a particular species of sphagnum, and that is papilosum, another species of sphagnum. We have bog cotton, Eriophorum vaginatum, and see these little things like barley? That's bog asphodel. The Latin is Narticeum acifagum. Despite the profusion visible to White's knowledgeable eye, the source of Lodge Bog's ecological value is its relative sparseness. Because everything's so specialized, you get fewer species, White said. Many of those species, like the sundew, live nowhere else. This unique flora, I reminded myself, once covered almost the entire bog of Allen. Under normal conditions, a plant removes carbon dioxide from the atmosphere through photosynthesis. When it drops its leaves or it dies, the carbon is returned to the atmosphere through decomposition. But things are different in a bog. It's anaerobic, waterlogged conditions. Plants die without rotting, rather than returning to the atmosphere. The carbon is stored. This means that bogs exert a net cooling effect on the climate. It also explains peat's historical use as a fuel source, both in domestic hearths and more recently on an industrial scale by Bord Nymona, the energy company whose excavated bogs have dominated the Midland since the late 1940s. Today, it is one of the region's principal employers. Peatlands, like those managed by the Bord, as the company is commonly known, are the largest carbon stores, not only in Ireland, but anywhere on the terrestrial planet. In all, they contain roughly twice the carbon of the world's forests. Estimates vary, but one report suggests there are 455 billion metric tons of carbon in the Northern Hemisphere's peatlands alone, which is equal to roughly half the carbon in the atmosphere. When a bog is drained or otherwise disturbed in the course of commercial extraction or domestic cutting or agricultural improvement, the peat begins to dry and decompose, releasing the carbon it has accumulated over thousands of years. A 2-meter-deep hectare of active peatland is estimated to extract almost a metric ton of carbon from the air per year and store up to 8,000 metric tons overall. If drained, that hectare would release an estimated 6 metric tons of carbon dioxide each year. Since the founding of the Turf Development Board, the board's predecessor, in 1933, peat has become a crucial power source in Ireland. During the oil crisis of the early 1970s, it provided as much as 40% of the country's electricity. But peat has never been an efficient fuel. A recent estimate found that it accounted for less than 8% of national electricity production, but as much as 20% of the sector's carbon emissions. Last year, Ireland's Climate Action Plan conceded that the country was way off course and vowed that by 2030, at least 70% of its electricity would come from renewable sources. Establishing the abandonment of peat fuel as national policy. The board had already announced in 2014 that it expected to stop extracting peat for fuel by 2030. But as climate drawdown has accelerated, the company has been forced to scale back far more quickly than planned and has eliminated hundreds of jobs. The impact of the Midlands economy and working culture has already proved devastating. But even a radical transformation in energy policy will not undo the ecological damage that peat extraction has caused. 50% of Europe's raised bogs are in Ireland, White told me as we walked back to the car. We have a legal obligation to protect them. But less than 10% are deemed worthy of conservation because they've all been impacted. The board plans to rehabilitate some, 77,000 hectares of its depleted bogs, mainly by re-wetting them and abandoning the sites to nature. But many conservationists think this is insufficient. In White's view, rehabilitation is not restoration, it's just stabilization. Those sites may cease to emit carbon, but the living bog will not return. So Now I'm going to play another track. First up, we had In White Rooms by Booker Shade. And now we're going to listen to Ain't Nobody by Jackie Graham, one of my favorite hits from the 80s. And I'll see you in a moment. So, I'm back. If Ireland's national consciousness can be sought in the matter of the country's terrain, it might be found in its bogs. Rainfall makes Ireland one of the boggiest countries on the planet, with peat covering 70% of its land. With an extraordinary ability to preserve anything that might fall into their depths, the bogs are a museum of Ireland's deep past. Among the items dug up from the Bog of Allen's, cast butter that has scarcely decayed since it was stowed centuries ago, 2 millennia-old leather shoes which look as if they were unlaced yesterday, Psalter, still legible after 800 years underground. The board has a partnership with the National Museum of Ireland, whose archaeologists manage such funds, many of which have emerged in the course of the company's excavations. For the poet Seamus Heaney, a kind of laureate of the bog, the landscape always had a strange assuaging effect, with associations reaching back into early childhood. The bog was liberty and community as well as labour. This ambiguous, borderless terrain, neither living nor dead, wet nor dry, public nor private, has never been politically neutral. Ireland's bogs were often viewed by city dwellers as fundamentally moribund. Gotta look that word up. Economic and cultural voids, the refuge of brigands, outcasts and hermits, synonymous with a semi-bestial peasantry. Miserable and half-starved spectres. According to one 19th century account, in folklore, bogs are the lairs of the shape-shifting puka. An 1828 study of fairy mythology called them wicked-minded, black-looking bad things, while in Edna O'Brien's classic 1960 novel, The Country Girls, the protagonists are contemptuously dismissed as fresh from the bogs. Throughout much of Irish history, the bogs were also seen as impediments to economic progress. In 1731, an Act of Parliament was passed to encourage the improvement of barren and wasteland. Barren and wasteland with capital letters, by the way. And bogs, and planting of timber trees and orchards. Okay, so this is the name of the bill. The bill is titled Barren and Wasteland and Bogs and Planting of Timber Trees and Orchards, so with capital B, W, L, B, P, T, T, and O. By the mid-19th century, some 30,000 hectares of bog had been reclaimed. Nevertheless, a geologist in Bram Stoker's 1890 Gothic novel, The Snake's Pass, quoting a former Archbishop of Dublin, still complains, "We live in an island almost infamous for bogs, and yet I do not remember that anyone has attempted much concerning them." This was not to say that the bogs were irredeemable. We cure a bog both by surgical and medical process. Stoker's geologist continues. We drain it so that its mechanical action as a sponge may be stopped, and we put in lime to kill the vital principle of its growth. We drain it so that its mechanical action as a sponge may be stopped, and we put in lime to kill the vital principle of its growth. In theory, the process was straightforward. Cutting networks of drainage ditches into the heart of a bog could dry out the peat, which could then be fertilized with lime, manured, and ploughed. A worthless bog was cured. But A bog is a product of climate and topography. It wants to be wet, just as a lake or a river does. Only through a tremendous, often uneconomical investment of human energy could a bog be turned into a field of potatoes or a grazing meadow. Fuel, however, was another matter. Turf, the term given to peat cut for domestic use, was the very stuff of the bog, and if impoverished tenant farmers confined to such intransigent ways land had any advantage, it was the ready availability of free fuel. Traditionally, once a bog had been drained, the living surface of plants and roots, the scraw, would be pried away, and the exposed peat dug out using a spade with a wing on one edge called a sleen, but it's spelled S-L-E-A-N with an accent above the A, I think, so I'm not sure how to pronounce it. Summer by summer, an escarpment of peat, perhaps 2 meters high, would advance from the bog's edges to its center, like an island being eroded by the sea. Once removed from the bog, the brick-sized sods of turf were spread out to drain for 10 days or so, then stood up to dry in inward-tilting circles of 5 or 6 rods each, a process called footing. These assemblages of footed sods are still a familiar sight on islands' private bogs, of which there are hundreds. Wow. Though these days, the sods are formed from macerated peat, machine excavated by contractors. By the end of the 19th century, bogs had come to function in British-ruled Ireland as a metaphor for a defiant national character. For advocates of British authority, reclaiming bogs was a way of subduing that character. For nationalists, the peatlands, as a potential domestic industrial resource, represented economic freedom. In 1946, after the obstruction of coal imports from Britain during the Second World War made the need for fuel self-sufficiency undeniable, an expansion of the Turf Development Board was announced, establishing a new semi-public company, Bord na Mona, peat board in English, an acerbic Irish Times columnist called the name an atrocious neo-decadent Irish title, one that lent a phony air of tradition to an entity set up for the purpose of incinerating large sections of your strictly limited Irish patrimony. But incineration at such a scale demanded a workforce to match, a welcome development in a region of historically scant employment. Those who get jobs in Bord na Mona didn't have to immigrate, one Bog of Allen resident told me. Lots of my relations went to England, America. The ones who were in Bord na Mona, they were staying at home. The post-war years saw the transition from sod peat bricks cut by hand from the bog or formed in a mechanical extruder to milled peat, a grainy, crumbly substance industrially sacrificed from a bog's surface. The milled peat is then either sent directly to power stations or ground into powder and compressed into oblong blocks to be sold as domestic fuel. Ask most people in Ireland what the board means to them, and they'll describe 12.5 kilogram bales of moulded briquettes embossed with the letters BNM, brittle as coal and bound in polypropylene strapping. They are widely available even now. Several Midlanders mentioned to me a TV commercial from 1986 preserved on YouTube. Oh, I'm going to look it up. As the fiddle player John Sheehan of the Dubliners plays the Merino Waltz, a succession of blissful household vignettes unfold. A man removes his shoes and warms his feet by the fire. A little girl clutches her teddy bear and gazes contentedly into the flames. A woman embraces the lover she's been waiting for. Each 2-second scene is illuminated by firelight. A special firelight, the kind endowed only by Pete. Not a word is spoken. The briquette represents a timeless domestic ideal. Pete, the board recognized, was far more than mere fuel. Bound up in its warmth, light, and odor, even in its mechanically mined and machine-compressed form, were generations of positive associations, comfort, love, the family as a unit of the nation. All right. Well, with that, I'm just going to prepare one more song, which I haven't prepared yet, so it's going to take me a moment. All right, and we're back. We're back. In 2003, near Croghan Hill, about 20 kilometres northwest of Lullymore, police were alerted to the discovery of a body. The state pathologist determined that it belonged to a tall man in his late 20s who had been stabbed to his death. His nipples had been sliced off and he had been beheaded. Gazing at what remains of his corpse, I could make out the whorls of his fingerprints, his manicured nails. He was not a working man, and the pores of his skin, skin that otherwise resembled an article of tanner's waste. Old Croghan Man, as he is known, had been lying quietly in the peat since he was sacrificed more than 2,000 years ago. In 2003, he was disturbed during the digging of a drain in a private bog. Now he is on show in a vitrine at the National Museum of Ireland in Dublin. When I visited, a couple of tourists joined me in the dim cubicle. One of them shuddered, slipped an iPad from her bag and took a photo. I couldn't help but feel there was something intrusive about our gawping. A notice informed us that twisted hazel ropes, known as withies, were inserted through cuts made in the upper arms and may have been employed to fasten down the body to the bottom of a bog pool. The bogs from which such bodies have been recovered often lie, as Croghan Hill does, on the boundaries between ancient kingdoms, no man's lands of uncertain sovereignty, where a life might be made to vanish. Why did they bury the bog bodies there? Asked Ray Stapleton, the manager of Lullymore Heritage and Discovery Park, when I met him the following day. Because it wasn't tribal land, it was seen as an outlying area. The bogs have always been wild. As its website explains, the park is the only attraction in Ireland offering a comprehensive insight into the Irish peatlands and the people living around them. We were sitting in Stapleton's office, the cataract of rain on the roof so noisy that we had to raise our voices. He told me that he had been born in nearby Rattingen, a village established by Quakers that had been dominated by bored Namona since the 1940s. It was like the Wild West, he said, of the town's heyday, when hundreds of men from all over Ireland were brought into the Midlands to cut peat for the nation's new power stations. Stapleton grew up cutting turf each summer on his family's plot. I knew the bogs were different, he said. You could find newts, dragonflies the size of your hand. The Heritage and Discovery Park was founded in 1993, partly to create local jobs following a series of cuts at the board. They had more modern machinery and didn't need as much manual labor, Stapleton told me. The park's exhibition, with its bearded Neolithic mannequins and dioramas, introduces the natural and industrial history of Lullymore, while beyond the cafe and miniature golf course, visitors can follow a biodiversity boardwalk to a flooded cutaway bog. What we've done is let the water back in, Stapleton said. You just let nature take it back. He conceded that the legacy of the board's activity in the region was environmental ruin. Environmental ruin. The peat was largely gone and would take centuries to return, but maintained that the company extracted something more than jobs or energy from the bogs. That was us saying we're an industrial country, a modern country. We're able to provide out of our own resources. We don't need British coal. We don't need British coal. Most of the park's overseas visitors are German, which Stapleton attributes to their own affinity for peatland. Technology pioneered on German bogs is still used by the board. British tourists have dropped off since Brexit, and few Americans venture so far from the established sightseeing trails. He admitted that it's a difficult sell. You're not going to the castle. You're not going to the wild Atlantic Way. You're not going to the cliffs of Moher. You're not going to Kilkenny. You're going to the bog. When the board's last bog closes, Stapleton would like to see the greater part of the Bog of Allen re-wetted, allowed to return to wilderness, and promoted as a green tourism destination, a kind of Irish safari park. I often wonder, what would it be like if we hadn't had to use our peat? I would have loved to have seen it when it was 20 feet up, like a big cloak. That's what the poet Matthew Ferrell said. He said that the bog was like a cloak, surrounding Lullymore, protecting it. Later that week, I read Ferrell's 1860 poem. It's partly a wheedling encomium to Lullymore's landlord, William Murphy, but also an earnest, if sub-Wordsworthian, celebration of the inland isles, girding bog. Its texture of the richest brown, set here and there with tufts of down, embroiled over with heath bell trees, and these bespangled over with bees, with silky folds of mossy beds, like pillows made for angels' heads, with mirror lakes divided through, where countless stars reflect their hue. Liberty Hall, the Dublin headquarters of the Services Industrial Professional and Technical Union, is a 16-storey tower block on the north bank of River Liffey, hand-painted on a metal shutter covering a ground-floor window are the words of James Connolly, the union leader who helped orchestrate the 1916 Easter Rising. The Irish people will only be free when they own everything from the plough to the stars. I was there to meet Willie Noon, the Services Industrial Professional and Technical Union's energy sector organiser, and a critic of how Board Nimona and the government have managed the termination of the peat industry. Years ago, people were put off the land by the English, he told me in a conference room overlooking the river, and it's built into the psyche that if you have land, you protect it. As we talked, His phone throbbed sporadically with incoming emails and texts. He was participating in a climate crisis debate that night on RTE, Ireland's national broadcaster, a Midlands native. Noon also grew up hand-cutting turf on his family's bog. When I was young, I hated it because it was such a seen as a chore, something you had to do. It was duty. It was dirty. You'd rather be off doing something else. But having returned to the Midlands after stints living in England and Australia, he's one of the few people who still cut and dry peat for their own hearth. It's like Guinness, he explained. I've never heard anyone who drank their first pint of Guinness and thought it was lovely. But if you go to any pub in the country, you'll see 12 old men at the bar, and you'll probably see 12 pints of Guinness. It's an acquired taste. The Midlands has tended to be viewed as peripheral, despite its proximity to the capital. But the region was transformed entirely in the 1940s by the establishment of the Board, and that's the Board Namona. They weren't ordinary jobs, said Noon. They were good jobs, real jobs, pensionable jobs, jobs for life, skilled jobs. The development of large-scale peat extraction had the dual benefit of strengthening Ireland's energy security and summoning thousands of jobs out of soil that historically had almost no economic value. Much of the Midlands still consists of small farms eking out an existence from land that precisely because of its peat remains marginal. All right. With that, I'm going to play one more song. And I'm going to play The Beast of Burden by this is Bette Midler's version. And I'm choosing this one because I don't know if anyone else follows Bette Midler on Twitter, but I'm just like really appreciating her tweets these days. She's really just sticking it to Donald Trump and just pointing out all the awful things that he says. And I really want to thank Bette Midler for that. So here it is. And you're on Soil Matters. This is Tanya. We're on Radio Patapu, and I'll see you. All right. Thanks. Thanks, Bette. Loved it. I hope you guys loved it too. I reckon she's pretty ace. And you're back on Soil Matters. We're on Radio Patapu and we're reading Bogland, an article published in Harper's by William Atkins. And it's talking about the heritage of peat over in Ireland. Peat extraction, like farm work, is seasonal, mostly taking place between July and September, when drier weather allows machines to access the bogs and the milled peat to dry. Most board contracts are for 10 months per year or less and permit a good deal of flexibility. That actually dovetailed in with the way of life in the Midland, Noon said. Bog work allowed Midlands farmers to earn a regular salary while continuing to maintain their own farms. Between the two of them, you had a good living. You could look after your mum and dad. You could send your kids to college. In other words, employment with the board offered a solution to the poverty and isolation that had been ingrained in the Midlands for generations, while keeping the population on the land. With the end of peat extraction, said Noon, all those farms go back to being uneconomical. In late 2018, the board announced that it was seeking to dismiss up to 430 of its 2,200 employees in a voluntary redundancy program. A year later, It was announced that two of Ireland's three remaining peat-burning power stations would close at the end of 2020 as part of what the government called an accelerated exit from peat that would see 2 million fewer metric tons burned each year. By then, many employees had already taken voluntary redundancy packages. The board paid out almost $46 million in voluntary redundancy compensation in 2018 alone. The board also established a just transition fund of $12 million for retaining the newly unemployed. But for most of the company's workers, whose average age is 56, it was too late to change careers. The problem with the Midlands is that it's all bogland, said Noon. And there's not too many things you can do in bogland. In April, a further 230 board members were temporarily let go because of the COVID-19 crisis. With demand for briquettes also declining, Noon estimated that about 700 jobs had been lost so far and believed more would follow. Given that the millions of metric tons of milled peat already stockpiled on the bogs and the uncertainty surrounding the remaining power station's future, most of the board's land will fall silent this year. The machinery will be sold off or scrapped, and the degraded bogs will be transformed into wind farms or reclaimed as wetlands. Rain was falling heavily upon the Bog of Allen. I stood outside Michael Kearney, a former board Namona employee. At the edge of a desert of black. In front of us, parallel runways of exposed peat 15 metres wide extended more than a kilometre into the hazy distance. Each strip was separated from its neighbour by a drainage ditch about 2 metres deep, its bottom bright with water. Running along the edge of every tenth bay was an embankment of stockpiled peat 3 metres high. People often describe the process of removing peat from a bog as harvesting. But though a bog may look like a field ready for sowing on Google Earth, up close the process resembles harvesting about as much as an array of wind turbines resembles a farm. It's more like an open pit mining. Still, looking out at the black expanse, Kearney had the air of one admiring a garden tended over a lifetime. When I suggested I grab my umbrella from his car, he suppressed a smile. You wouldn't see many umbrellas on the bog. This was Ballydermot Bog, which Kearney managed for the board for 20 years before he retired in mid-2018. A cutaway bog, like Ballydermot, needs to be closely monitored. It may be dead, but it's mutable and moody. Its nature can change from hour to hour, and the amount of peat it yields on any given day can differ wildly from that of neighbouring bogs. A bog manager's enemies are water and fire. Heavy rain makes a bog too soft to be worked safely. It can take days to recover sunken machinery. Bogmen still talk about 2012, the worst year in the board's history, when the summer rains were so intense that by winter the power stations were close to exhausting their reserves. If we had another year like 2012, the power stations would have closed, said Kearney. But the following summer turned out to be a record breaker, dry and hot month after month, putting the bogs at risk of catching fire. Blazes triggered by sparks from machinery or spontaneous combustion have caused millions of dollars of damage to the board's bogs. For that reason, part of the manager's job is simply to watch. When a fire breaks out, there is nothing to be done but drive a bulldozer onto the stockpile and attempt to smother the flames with more peat. A fire'd be gone out, and after 20 minutes you'd see just a little wisp of smoke, said Kearney. You could spend all night watching it. As we returned to the car, the deluge gradually gave way to a fine, directionless drizzle. Braden in Irish, misty rain. We passed a comparatively pristine margin of uncut bog, a tussocked carpet of mosses, grasses, and heather, not unlike lodge bog. This is the way the bog was, Kearney said without sentiment. Before Ballydermot was excavated in the 1940s, he reckoned, its surface would have been 10 times higher than it is today. 10 times higher than it is today. The height of a 2-story building. We're actually down to the lack. Lack. Nobody I asked was sure of the correct spelling. It's a regional term for the ground under the peat, far below the natural organic surface of the earth, which thousands of years ago would have been the bed of the lake from which the bog developed. Perhaps the word derives from lake, but it appears in neither Irish nor English dictionaries. Looking back into the excavated void, the bog's floor of gravel and limestone exposed, I had a momentary sense of being on the bed of a drained ocean, the dark mass overhead crushing in its absence. It was just a few minutes from Ballydermot's bog to Kearney's home in the village of Clonbullogue. We drove back through the rain. Clarknock now, a torrent, although the route he'd taken almost daily for 20 years. Along the route he'd taken almost daily for 20 years. One of our managing directors actually worked his way up from working on the bog as a general operator, he said. And now, I asked, they wouldn't know what a bog looks like. A few years ago, Kearney said, the board hired a consulting firm to improve efficiency. We had to put a flowchart up in the office. One lad had worked for PricewaterhouseCoopers, the accountancy firm. We had to tell him what we did on the bog from start to finish, and he came back in 6 months to tell us how to do it better. He uttered the final word with a certain dryness. Kearney's home was a smart white row house on the village green. A sign read, Tidy Town's bronze medal winner. As we entered, I apologized to Josephine, Michael's wife, for dripping water on the floor. As if we aren't used to that, she said, leading me through to the kitchen. By the door to the backyard, brick-sized sods of dried peat were stacked against the kitchen counter. The same peat was blazing in the kitchen stove, and there was more stored in the shed, and more still, 20 metric tons, to last the winter in another building. "You'll have a slice of toast," she said, dropping bread into the toaster. She left us alone for a moment, returning with a framed black-and-white photo of a handsome, smiling, middle-aged couple on a peat bog. The woman was seated on a bench cut into a cliff face of peat. In front of her was a folding table on which stood a tin kettle and a jar of Bovril. The man, atop the uncut bog behind her, was clutching a sledden. "Daddy and Mummy on the bog," said Josephine fondly. All right, with that, I'm going to play another tune. And you all already know I'm a huge fan of Dolly Parton, and I'm playing her tune now because I think Dolly's also someone who said some great words recently, mainly in relation to the discussion around the Black Lives Matter movement, and she's made some comments basically saying, well, if people are upset, then I'm just gonna change the way I do things so that people aren't so upset anymore. I think in relation, maybe, I'm not sure, to some of her lyrics also. So I think, yeah, it's like very practical and very simple, and we can all take some inspiration from Dolly perhaps today. So this one's Jolene, and thanks for listening to Soil Matters. All right, so we're almost at the end. I didn't realize we just had a couple of sentences left, or I would have finished it off in one go. But here we go. This is the final paragraph. We're going to read it together. Nobody ever believed that peat was depthless, or that its removal at an industrial scale was anything less than violence done to the land and the country's strictly limited Irish patrimony. But even despoliation can look like an act of largesse in certain circumstances. If there is fatalism among the board's workers now, it's only because they know that the company's raison d'être has never been anything but provisional. The lack was always there, waiting to be exposed. So that was Bogland by William Atkins. He's also the author of a book called The Immeasurable World, A Desert Journey. But yeah, I'm not sure if I really agree. I reckon people really felt, I don't know if they believed. Yeah, I think some people kind of felt and believed that the peat was depthless. I feel like people know that there's coal is a finite resource, but there's also this perception maybe that we're not going to meet its end in our lifetime, so we can treat it as if it's actually an infinite resource. And I could imagine that people could have a similar relationship to a bog. But I don't know. And even if people in our generation don't have that perception of coal, I think people in the previous generation definitely had that perception of coal and oil. But I guess what we learn is not that these resources are coming to an end, but converting them into a greenhouse gas creates a lifestyle, creates a planet that we're not used to, like, habitating. So it's like it brings us to a discomfort by converting them from something solid to their gaseous state. And so that's why we say to keep it in the ground. And on that, I also want to mention the Repeat group. We have a petition out at the moment, and it's called Peat Free Horticulture, Keep Peat in the Ground. And it's collates some information about why peat should stay in the ground, why it's extracted, and particularly in relation to peat being used as part of potting mix and these bags of soil that you can buy in garden centres to use in your own home garden, and that we should find peat-free alternatives. So that's a really, really great petition to sign, and you can find it at repeat.earth, and repeat is with a minus sign between the re and the peat. And I also just want to tell you a bit about a great article that came out recently. And it's titled Large Stocks of Peatland Carbon and Nitrogen Are Vulnerable to Permafrost Thaw. And it's basically talking about the stocks of carbon and nitrogen that are stored in permafrost in the northern Arctic regions, and the potential for this to be released with climate change, with anthropogenic climate change, and what the impacts might be. So that's a really, really great article. It's by Gustav Hugelis, and there's like about 10 authors after that. But it was just published in June of this year. So really recent, hot off the press. Definitely recommend reading it. I'll put a link in the notes also to the repeat petition. And I also want to tell you about some other upcoming events. So Repeat are also having a picnic on the 29th of August, which is next Saturday, and we're going to talk about the petition and the facts in there and what this means for our lives and the environment and policy and what can we do about it. And that's going to be really, really nice. And that's happening in Amstel Park, and everyone's super welcome to come and bring a blanket and some snacks. Another great event that's also happening in Amstel Park is on the 19th of September, and we're going to describe and analyze a peat core, and that's going to be really, really fun. We're going to get, it's a 10-meter core taken from within the Amstel Park itself, and we're going to analyze it live, and we're going to discuss it, and we're also going to discuss the fact that we have appropriated the peat core without its consent, and what does that mean, and what does it bring us, and what can we do from here. And then on the 15th to the 17th of September is the ICOS conference, and basically if anyone's interested in the movement of carbon in the atmosphere, but particularly between in the land surface. ICOS stands for Integrated Carbon Observation System, and it's going to be an online conference this year, of course, because of Corona. So it'll take place virtually, and it's going to be a bunch of scientists talking about their latest research. So it'll be super interesting. This is the fourth time that it takes place. It was meant to be in Utrecht in person, but it's going to be virtual. And I really recommend registering and being part of that. And you can go to icos-cp.eu to register. And I reckon, and I'm planning to do like a highlights radio show the Friday after that conference, because I just think it will be really, really interesting. But I think that's all for me for now. I'm going to play one more song. I'm not sure yet. I haven't got it ready. But please email me at soil_series@riseup.net and follow our account on Mixcloud and listen to past episodes at mixcloud.com/soil_matters. And I'm Tanya, and you're on Radio Patapu listening to Soil Matters. And it's been really, really great to have like a PD bog day with you, and I've really enjoyed it. And I hope you're surviving the heat in Amsterdam, and really looking forward to talking to you next week. Thank you so much. Ciao, ciao.